Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can things that happen before we are born shape the people we become? Filmmaker and activist Sochita Pav knew her parents and siblings had survived the ravages of the Khmer Rouge's chokehold on Cambodia. They called her the lucky one, born in the relative safety of a Thai refugee camp with no real memories of her life before the family moved to Texas. She wondered about those horrible years that preceded her birth, but learned early that her questions would not be answered. In fact, the stifled sorrows of Pub's family were greater than she could have imagined until her mother made a stunning revelation over the Christmas holidays in 2002. Since then, Pub has worked not only to learn her own family stories, but to help other families preserve and honor theirs. So Sochita Pav is CEO of the nonprofit group Khmer Legacies, which encourages children of survivors to create a video archive of the Cambodian genocide. Her award-winning documentary New Year Baby debuts tonight as a PBS Independent Lens special. It will air on KERA Channel 13 television at 10 o'clock. Sochita, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you asked about the Khmer Rouge as a kid, you didn't even really understand what that meant. Your family wouldn't answer, and so you were left to sort of imagine what that meant.
Yeah, that's correct. We never really had conversations about what it was like for my parents to have lived through that.
And did you sense then that they were trying to protect you or that they simply didn't want to tell you?
All I knew was that there was something there that they didn't want to discuss. For instance, I remember being in the third grade once and having to do a school paper about, you know, my family's life or my parents' life. And I was asking my mother these questions, and at some point she said, I just can't talk about this anymore, and she walked out of the room. So that was one of the first signals that I ever had that this is something that we didn't talk about in our family.
Your family called you the lucky one. Did that make you feel different?
It definitely made me feel a little bit outside of my family, outside of their experience. You know, everyone else in my family, my parents, my two older sisters, and my brother, all had lived through this terrible thing, and so they shared this history together. And I was the only one who was left untouched by this history. So it felt, in a way, as if there was something that I would never really understand about them.
Did your sisters and your brother, do you think they envied you?
Oh, absolutely. Not just for being the one who was born after the Khmer Rouge fell, but also because, you know, I grew up in America with all of the opportunities and the privileges that come with that.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if oddly, you sort of envied them for having that thing that they could share with your parents that you didn't.
In a strange way, I don't know if I would call it envy, but I definitely felt less close to them because they had this experience together, and I never did.
Did you have other Cambodian friends growing up?
I had a few Cambodian friends. There isn't a huge Cambodian community in Dallas, but my mother is a very sociable woman, and so I felt like she knew all of the Cambodians around town. And so they were always at our house. In terms of the school that I went to in Carrollton, there were very, very few Cambodians. I think maybe there was one other family, you know, who had children around my age going through the school system together.
So it wasn't like you had a lot of contemporaries with whom you could sort of commiserate about growing up in a family that had this kind of separation in it.
No, not at all. And in fact, when I was growing up, you know, going through elementary school, more often than not, people thought I was Mexican because, you know, because of my darker skin. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your family's Buddhist, but you're in the sort of American habit of celebrating Christmas every year in a typical fashion. Can you talk about what happened in 2002?
Absolutely. On that particular Christmas, all of the kids were at home, my sisters, my brother, and I, and so my mother decided to call this family meeting, and she took us to a back bedroom and closed the door, and in that meeting, she began to tell us that even though she had raised all of us in this normal nuclear family, we're not normal or nuclear at all, and in fact, my family is really a patchwork quilt of survivors. For instance, my sisters are my biological cousins. My brother is my half-brother, and that made me the only child of my two parents.
So clearly they had all known these things, and you were the only one who didn't know.
Well, my sisters were old enough to remember their first family, so they knew. My brother did not know, though, so we were the two that this confession was for, in a way.
Was your father in the room when your mother was talking to you?
He was in the room, and he got very, very emotional and actually ended up running out of the room and locking himself in the bathroom. And it was my sister who had to get him out of there to tell him that it was okay. You know, he could come out.
Yeah, there's kind of a sweet story when they talk about that, because everyone's sort of laughing about it. But it does seem like a really, it must have been hard for him to sort of step off that precipice and sort of speak out loud about things that were different.
Absolutely. I mean, for so long, you know, he had been the father in this family. And so in this one confession, to almost admit that he wasn't, in a way, you know, was very, very hard for him. Yeah, he felt very vulnerable in that moment.
What do your sisters remember about their first parents?
Well, my sisters were, I believe, around 9 and 6 when their first parents died or were taken away by the Khmer Rouge and we believe, killed. They remember two very loving parents. They had many brothers. Actually, they had 3 brothers that they had grown up with who were all younger. And they had a pretty privileged life in Cambodia. They lived in the capital city and had a nice, beautiful home. Their father worked at the bank, so he had a nice job.
And one of your sisters remembered, once they were in forced labor, being sort of sick, and her mother would sacrifice her own food and sneak it to her when she was ill.
Yes, it was one particular story, a very touching story that my sister Mala tells in the film, where she was taken to the Khmer Rouge hospital. And what you mean by hospital is really a place where people waited to die because there was no food or medicine to be had there. And her mother did not know she was there, but found her one day and said, "I've been waiting to eat all day, so I've saved my lunch for you." And my sister really credits her mother, her biological mother, for saving her life.
Yeah, and ultimately her mother died out of hunger, and then finally she had an attack of diarrhea and just couldn't survive it.
That's right, yeah. Very common way that many, many Cambodians died during that time.
Just that night that she died, you know, it didn't hit me. I was like, fine, you know, she died. There's a man came over. They prepare the body, you know, just like dressed her, you know, and they roll her up in the cradle, and then he just carry her away. When they took her body away, I went and washed her clothes, and that's when I just, like, I was crying at the river. It's like, she's actually gone. She's dead, you know.
So, Tita, what an extraordinary revelation for you to understand that your sisters, who you've known all your life, have this huge history of loss that you didn't even know about as a child.
Right. It was really astounding, and it really transformed what I thought my family was, you know, who my parents were, who my sisters were, the life experience that they had. It really just kind of opened up this whole other world for me.
Did you find yourself remembering a series of moments where you thought, oh, that's what that meant, or now I understand this happening or that one?
Absolutely. I mean, certain family dynamics, it really became clear to me, you know, the root of them. My sisters are wonderful people, and for as long as I have known them, they have felt a sense of indebtedness, mm-hmm. and gratitude toward my parents. And I mean, I feel that, you know, in a similar way, but my sisters in particular had this very deep sense of needing to pay back my parents, especially my mother. And it really was almost a burden to them. And I really never understood that until I understood their story.
That's funny, because I guess one could have imagined, or you would have imagined, well, I'm just this kind of ungrateful American kid who doesn't feel this way about my parents. But it had to do with them being aware that they were taken in when they had no one else.
Exactly. And because of that experience, that's what had them feel this way to my parents. And it's not something that I felt in the same way, you know, because my experience was so different.
Were you angry at all at your family for not having shared this with you earlier?
I could understand why they kept this secret. I can't say that I was angry at them, but I did feel this tinge of betrayal, this sense of, I don't understand why my parents didn't trust me with this information. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but imagine that my brother felt that way too, because he was much older than me when he found out. You know, he was already 30 at this point.
Mm-hmm. It's funny to think about your sisters being able to keep that secret for such a long time. Do you think they talked, you know, among themselves and just waited till you were out of the room?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they did. And they also talked to other relatives who knew the truth, but made sure to keep it away from us and to keep it away from the public in general.
So in order to explore this, because you didn't come from a family where there's a culture of speaking openly about things, obviously, you decided that you would make this film. How receptive was everyone to the idea?
Well, that was the central tension of the film, was that I wanted to understand this story. I wanted to document it and make this film out of it. And my parents didn't want to talk about it. And they certainly didn't want to talk about certain secrets about their relationship that they had kept for so long. So it was definitely, there was definitely a lot of tension in that process.
And had you interviewed them about anything before? This was your first documentary, is that right?
This is my first documentary, mm-hmm. and I had never really taken on understanding my family's history like this before.
Well, it's funny that you chose to do it on film, because most people would imagine that was intimidating, and yet I can see, you know, I interview people for 2 hours a day and ask them things that I might not ask my own parents.
Right, right. Yes, well, in fact, I thought about writing a book in the beginning, but because my background is in television news, it felt more natural to make a documentary film. And having that role of being a documentary filmmaker while I was on this trip to Cambodia with my parents is part of what gave me the courage in the first place to ask those hard questions and to take them to those emotional places that they didn't want to go to and I necessarily didn't want to push them into.
Filmmaker Sochita Puv is my guest. Her film, New Year Baby, will appear tonight on KERA Channel 13 Television. It's an independent lens documentary. So you went back with your parents to Cambodia. You took your mother to the place where she had lived in a camp, and she sort of shut down after just a few seconds.
Yeah, it was a very peculiar sequence of events because we spent about 2 hours in the car in this terrible dirt road, pockmarked with holes. And we got out of the car, and my mother said, okay, this is the old clinic, and this is where I used to be, and it's time to go now. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the first signals when we were in Cambodia that she really didn't want to kind of go all the way with this journey.
Did you get a sense that she was almost afraid when she stepped back out, or simply just didn't want to confront what came rushing back at her?
She was definitely nervous, I could tell, and trepidatious about the emotions that would come up again once she was standing in that place.
Mm-hmm. And was there any trying to sort of wheedle her to stay, or that was it?
I was young. I was unprepared at that point when I was in the beginning of that particular trip. So I think if I had done that, if that had happened later in the trip, I probably would have found a way to ask my mom to stop and to go back or something. But I was unprepared for her abruptness.
Mm-hmm. So Sochita Puv is my guest. She's a filmmaker and CEO of Khmer Legacies, which is working to create a video archive of the Cambodian genocide. Her documentary, New Year Baby, will appear as an independent lens documentary special tonight at 10 on KERA Channel 13. We'll return to our conversation with Sochita in just a moment. Also take your calls. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is filmmaker Sochita Pub. She is also the CEO of Khmer Legacies, which is creating a video archive of Cambodian genocide. Her documentary, New Year Baby, will appear as an independent lens special tonight on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Chita, was it easier to talk to your sisters? In other words, were they less resistant to answering your questions than your parents were?
They were. And in fact, I think reliving some of their memories was a relief for them because for the first time, they felt like they could openly share some of their stories.
Yeah, there's this amazing when they talk about, and we'll play the clip in a moment, but when they talk about the moment that they were sort of set free and what that must have been like.
Yes, absolutely. It's an astounding story of survival because they were in a children's camp separated from all adults, and they were actually taken to this place where they found this huge storage of rice. And I just have this amazing image in my head of these two little girls playing in this huge silo of rice, you know, just celebrating the fact that they found this food and they were alive.
In 1979, the Khmer Rouge fell when the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia. Cambodians flooded out of the labor camps. My sisters, Mala and Lakina, who were lost from the rest of the family, were liberated from their children's camp. But they didn't know it.
I remember that one evening, all of us, hundreds or even thousands of kids, just lined up by group. On the ground like that, sitting in line. And then my name was called.
I think Bong La, she realized that we're gonna be separated here. Well, so she stood up and she said, I want to stay with my sister.
And we get to leave together. You know who let us, like a 14-year-old, carry a rifle? They want to take the children to the mountains.
Even the mountain.
It was like close to the mountains. We had no idea whether they're going to kill us then or had no idea. They took us to this village. And when we got there, we saw this lady and she told us, follow me. And she took us to this little one room, little cottage. So we climbed up there. Which is a mound
of
rice almost to the ceiling. And so she's like, take what you can.
So finally they would eat after years of practically starving.
Absolutely, yeah.
Your sisters both have kids now?
Yes, they're both married and have 5 children between the two of them.
Do you think the same sort of generation gap exists between them and their children that exists between you and your parents?
I don't think so. I think the cultural barriers that were there between my generation and my parents are not there for my sisters and their children. My nieces and nephews are very, very Americanized, mm-hmm. But I feel like my sisters can bridge that gap much easier.
Do you see any of the legacy of this in the way they mother?
I see them be really, really savoring the experience of being a mother, just really falling in love with it. And I can't help but imagine that in a way it's kind of reclaiming what they lost, you know, when they were children and lost their mother.
Mm-hmm. So your mother really shut down from the project sort of early on, and so you turned to your father. I'm wondering if you already had an easier relationship with him than with your mother.
In a way, it was. In a way, I've always been, you know, daddy's little girl. And he was just happy and delighted to spend time with me and have this special time with me. So in a sense, it was easier. I'm also very close to my mom. But in this particular way, it was difficult to get through to her.
Sure. You did put your dad through some tough experiences. Did you ever sort of hesitate before, for example, you went and took him to see someone who had been with the Khmer Rouge?
Right. Yes. Well, if the first tension or the central tension of the film is this idea that I wanted to get my parents to talk and they didn't want to tell me their whole story, I would say the secondary or underlying tension was this role that I had both as a filmmaker but also as a daughter and in wanting to protect my parents. And so I would take my father and we would go and do these things such as confront the former Khmer Rouge district chief of the very district where he was. And there was definitely a part of me that felt so terrible about doing this to my father, you know, having him go through these emotions again.
What is your parents' relationship to each other?
I would say that my parents do love each other, and they both have been so committed for so long to this family, to saving this family, and then having us grow up and succeed in America. But they've never invested very much in their relationship together, in the sense of being a couple, you know, being a romantic couple, and kind of unpacking and understanding that relationship is really the large secret that is revealed in the film.
Yeah, well, one thing that really struck me was, you know, when you're talking to your mother and your parents together, at one point your mother says she likes your father best when he's not talking,
right.
Which I don't think is probably unique to your parents. But, you know, your mom talks about, you know, the huge differences in class and ethnicity. And, you know, they came from a place where what the Khmer Rouge wanted was to completely eliminate class. So it's almost as if it became even more important under this regime for people who had been stripped of all that to sort of hang on to.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like their marriage is kind of emblematic of what was happening in Cambodia, what the Khmer Rouge were trying to do in this sense. When my parents were growing up, you know, the class division was very, very strict. It was almost like a caste system. You know, someone of my mother's class would not even look at someone of my father's class. And so during the Khmer Rouge, when the Khmer Rouge wanted to dissolve the distinctions between classes, they would sometimes force people of different classes to marry. And there are even stories of the Khmer Rouge trying to punish, you know, female members of the Cambodian royal family by forcing them to marry handicapped Khmer Rouge soldiers. They really use this marriage as a way to control the population.
And your mother had Chinese blood, has Chinese blood, which is considered sort of superior to people who are purely Cambodian.
That's right. Yeah, she's lighter skinned, and that in and of itself is a huge deal in Cambodia.
And your father actually uses lightening creams or has on his skin?
Oh, no, he doesn't.
He doesn't. Okay.
He tries to stay out of the sun, and he's always berating me to stay out of the sun, but I've never known him to use any potions or lotions or anything.
He did finally, though, admit to you that he accepted a forced marriage with your mother because he knew that she had taken on, that she had this son, and that she had taken on her sister's children, and he felt sorry for her being alone.
Yeah, I mean, I think he also really liked her and liked the idea of having this already made family. You know, my father is someone who was an orphan, whose mother died when he was an infant, and he was raised by his parents. So he's always dreamed of having a family, and just to kind of, you know, pick a complete family up like this, I think that appealed to him as well.
The Khmer Rouge forced my parents, two strangers, to marry because they were so different. After the meeting, my father collapsed in exhaustion. I thought about calling off the rest of the journey. Maybe I pushed him too far. I began to question my reasons for this trip. Was it to understand my parents? Or was it just to ease my guilt about being the lucky one?
That is a clip from the Independent Lens documentary New Year Baby that will debut tonight at 10 on KERA Channel 13 television. The filmmaker is with us, Sachita Pav. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. Learning that your parents didn't choose each other in a way that would feel familiar to us in this country, was that a moment that hurt you and made you feel sorry for them, or somehow did it make you feel closer to them for having stuck it out anyway?
I think a little bit of both. Of course, growing up, you know, in America, you have this idea of what a marriage should look like, of a romantic relationship. And I always had the model of Claire and Heathcliff Huxtable, you know, after growing up in the 80s and the 90s. And my parents, you know, fell short of that model. On the other hand, knowing that they were forced to marry but then stayed together out of commitment to this family, for me, raised my level of respect and esteem for the choice that they made.
Looking back, do you think that your father had a different relationship to you because you were his only child by blood, or could you not tell the difference growing up between you and your sisters and your brother?
I have to say that I could definitely sense that I was the his favorite one, the special one, and sometimes that felt a little bit uncomfortable. In Cambodia, it is perfectly acceptable to treat your biological children, you know, much better, much higher status than you would any adopted children that you are raising.
Mm-hmm.
I think my mother, you know, didn't want that and kind of fought against that. And that's why she kept this secret for so long, in part. But even growing up, I could sense that there was some dynamic there.
There are a couple of long-delayed rituals in the film that you arrange, and one of them is that you present your parents with a wedding cake. Did you need to confirm for yourself somehow that they do love each other after all?
I think I did, because I had so many questions about that, and even though I admire the fact that they demonstrated such extraordinary commitment, you know, to stay together even though they're not compatible people, I wanted to know that it wasn't just for us, you know, everything wasn't just for us, because if it was, that meant that there was also a pressure for us as children to be the reason that they're together.
Yeah, that's a lot to place on anybody.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I wanted to almost give them permission, you know, to celebrate their relationship.
Looking back at those moments, is it something that, I mean, it sounds like it made your family closer, but I'm wondering if it's also still hard to think about those very emotional times.
Of course it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I actually think my family, having seen the audience react to the film, that's really what has been very healing for them, you know, to have the audience affirm their story and to say, yes, you did this, and we think that what you did was very heroic.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you do talk in the film about your parents repeating over and over, we're not special, there were so many others, and, you know, we survived, but that was as far as it went. It's almost like they didn't believe that anybody would think it was a big deal.
Exactly, because everyone that they knew, all the Cambodians that they had known, had gone through the same journey, the same path. And that is definitely true. You know, I say that this story is a remarkable story, but a common one.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is filmmaker Sochita Puv. Her film New Year Baby will debut tonight at 10 on KERA Channel 13. Let's speak next to Armara in Dallas. Hi, Armara.
Hi. This is the very first time I call.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. I was very interested when they talk about Cambodian people, because I went through all of that during the Khmer Rouge and everything, starvation, lost all the family, most of the family.
I'm so
and
sorry.
It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just getting nervous to never talk on the radio before.
Well, you know what, Armara, do me a favor and switch your radio off if it's on in the background, because that may be distracting you. Let me ask you this. Are you hearing things in the story of Sochita's family that remind you of things that you went through?
A lot. Mm-hmm. A lot. Because I barely survived myself, because I was there, and I lost my mom, and I lost my sister, my youngest sister, during the war. I lost my grandfather, and cousins, tons of cousins, and aunts and uncles during the war. But what I want to make the comments is that people become stronger. It's so normal to everybody that over there that went through all of these and didn't even think any big deal out of it.
Yeah.
Like things happen over here, like Katrina victims and all that kind of stuff. I say, oh, you know.
Yeah. Is it frustrating to you that in this country, the culture is very, you know, quick to focus on loss?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think people can make themselves stronger and deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your call, and we're glad you made it here.
Thank you so much.
So, Gita, was that an issue with you and your parents? Did they, you know, was it hard to sort of get their sympathy for small troubles in high school or whatever you dealt with as a kid?
Oh, yes, absolutely. No deal of heartache or trauma that you endured as a teenager could compare to, you know, having lived through a genocide. But I also want to echo what Amara said. I really see this film not as a film about loss, but as a film that celebrates the heroism and the honor that survivors like my parents brought to their lives and, I think, add to this country.
There's a wonderful scene where you've asked your mother why she thinks she survived and other people died. And basically, and maybe this is something that you get from her, she talks about being a storyteller.
Exactly. She tells this amazing story of how she managed to steal extra rice from the Khmer Rouge, which is that she, while she was processing the rice on the machine, she would tell these great stories to the Khmer Rouge leader and essentially distract her while her friends would sneak behind the Khmer Rouge leader's back and steal rice. And then they would always save a cut for my mom. And it's little things like this. My mom is quite the trickster. Little things like this that is what had her survive.
And one of the reasons she worried about her sister who did die was she felt like her sister wasn't quite as good at that as she was.
Yeah, I think my mom is among one of the most cunning people I know. Yeah, and that skill definitely served her.
So Gita Puv is my guest. She's a filmmaker. She's made a documentary called New Year Baby that you can see tonight at 10 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. She's also the CEO of a group called Khmer Legacies, which is creating a video archive of the Cambodian genocide through the eyes of families who dealt with it. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is filmmaker Sochita Puv. Her documentary New Year Baby will appear tonight on KERA Channel 13 television as an independent lens special. If you'd like to join the conversation, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. One of the really interesting things that you did was go back and meet your parents' families. And it's remarkable. I know you shot this a couple of years ago, but your mom and dad are quite young-looking and very attractive, and it's remarkable how different they look from their relatives who stayed in Cambodia.
Yes, you could really see how difficult the life is in Cambodia on the faces of my relatives, you know, how much they have aged.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Was it hard? Your parents have been back independent at the time that you went with them, is that right?
Yes, they returned to Cambodia 10 years before I went with them.
So it probably still took them by surprise to see how their loved ones had aged.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, the whole experience of returning to Cambodia for them is really a sad one, you know, to see how their country is still struggling, to see how the relatives are still struggling as well.
Mm-hmm. Are there people who pressured them not to go to the U.S., or did everyone agree at the time, maybe you don't know this, did everyone agree that if you could get out of Cambodia, you ought to do so?
I don't think they received any pressure to stay in Cambodia, but there were certainly relatives who did not make that choice to leave. At that moment, they felt like, you know, the Khmer Rouge had fallen. It's only uphill from here. Let's rebuild our lives in our homeland. And for my mother, it was a very clear choice for her. I mean, she really felt like there was nothing left for her in her country. And so she made the choice to leave.
Living in the U.S., and you got here when you were a toddler, an infant?
I was 2 years old.
Okay. You've had a first-class education. Was it something that your brother and your sisters were able to have as well?
I think it was more difficult for them because, I was able to learn English concurrent with learning Cambodian. Mm-hmm. For them, English was their second language, so not only did they have to deal with all the cultural issues and the poverty issues of being a refugee family, but they didn't speak the language. And so, grade school was hard for them.
So you became really, in some ways, the liaison for your family, not only to English, but to American culture.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I introduced them to Sesame Street and other American things that they would not have access to otherwise.
So Cheetah Puv is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next to Haz in Dallas. Hi, Haz.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Wonderful. Well, I really more have a comment. I just wanted to give her kudos to being able to assimilate to the American culture and being able to take the first generation, if you will, being an American to that next level in terms of being able to understand that opportunities are available to anyone. I myself am from Africa, from Nigeria, and I'm the first generation here to the States. My parents left during a coup, and so I can understand some of the hardships that she went through. But I also do have a question for her. In terms of her parents' assimilation to the States, how did that go over? Because I know earlier she referenced that there was a different classism between her father and her mother with regards to skin color or something like that, which is I find odd but understandable. I mean, especially even in America's history. Can she expound a little bit on that?
Thanks for your call.
Uh-huh.
Sure. For my parents, it was much more difficult to assimilate than for the rest of my siblings. All of us kids had the opportunity to go to school, whereas my parents had the pressure of having to provide for a family of six, right away. And so my mom often had to work two jobs. Sometimes my parents would work. My mom would work one shift. My dad would work the night shift, and so they could switch off being at home. And so the kind of pressure to survive and to keep up, I don't think it helped, their language skills and other education that was available in this country. However, my mother speaks English quite well. My dad speaks English a little less well, and I attribute that to the fact that when my father entered the job force, he was working around a lot of Cambodians, whereas my mom was working with a lot of, Americans. So.
How did the work that they had here compare with what they'd been doing in Cambodia? Not in forced labor, but their chosen careers before the
career. Right. Well, my mother, her first job was in a sweatshop. And it's interesting for me to see how sewing really served her entire life, because my mother's parents in Cambodia had sewing factories, and she herself had a sewing shop in the capital city before the Khmer Rouge. She would often sew during the Khmer Rouge time to help get some extra money, and she would sew in the refugee camps to barter for food. And then when she came to the U.S., that skill still served her. My father's very first job was as a janitor at JCPenney in a mall. And I can remember being very proud of him for working at this really American place, the mall. And he had a little uniform and everything. So, they've had blue-collar jobs for their entire time here in the U.S.
And one of the things that when your father was going back and forth, and we haven't talked about this, but your father made five trips back into Cambodia from Thailand to sort of bring the whole family over.
That's right. He made four trips. The first two were for family members, and then the third one was for a sewing machine, the very sewing machine that my mother would use to create a little micro business to get extra food. And then the last trip was for about four other people, my mom's relatives.
And every one of those trips was put your father at great peril.
Every single one of those trips was dangerous, and my mother was very nervous about whether or not my father would return. Many people did not make those trips. There were landmines, laced along the border, as well as militia, both Khmer Rouge militia and Vietnamese, militia that kept you from passing.
It is, though, an amazing sign of hopefulness that they chose to bring a child into the world even after what they just experienced. Do you feel like you represent that for your parents?
I do, and I recently found out that my name, Sochita, means noble birth. And so I think the decision to have me, you know, to conceive me and to have me was this huge affirmation of life. And in fact, the generation after the genocide was a huge baby boom in Cambodia. I think Cambodia at that point, after the Khmer Rouge fell, had the highest birth rate in Asia. And this is a common thing that happened after the Holocaust when, you know, the birth rate in the DP camps were among the highest in the world.
Do you know whether the same sort of generation gap exists even in Cambodia? In other words, people born after the Khmer Rouge had fallen can't relate entirely to what their parents and older siblings dealt with.
It's true. Of course, it's not as obvious as, you know, for those in the Cambodian diaspora that moved to a different country. But what you find in Cambodia, because parents often don't tell their children and because it's not reinforced in their school system or through the media sometimes, is that some of the young generation don't believe that the Khmer Rouge genocide even happened.
And it remains, no one from the Khmer Rouge has ever been prosecuted. Is that right?
Well, actually, this year in 2008, there is starting a UN-backed tribunal to prosecute the Khmer Rouge.
And do you know how many names are on the list to be processed?
It will just be a handful, I believe, less than 10. Right now, the tribunal is in the investigation stage. So I don't believe that anyone has been charged yet, but senior members of the Khmer Rouge have been detained.
When you met the district commander who was in charge of your father's area, did you sense any remorse? He talked to you about, I've already forgotten so much and it's important for me to remember, but what feeling did you get about his emotions regarding the whole thing?
He certainly had a lot of regret that he was involved and that this whole thing happened. But what I didn't see was a sense of feeling of responsibility that he felt like he was actually a part of the Khmer Rouge. And he was a district chief, so he was in charge of hundreds of families, you know. He did have authority, but he himself had not gone through that that process of understanding, you know, what was my responsibility in this. And so that's what surprised me and disappointed me about that meeting.
So everybody, or the ones that you met, all were able to say to themselves, well, I was just a cog in the wheel, and the Khmer Rouge was something much bigger than I.
That's right. I was just fulfilling the orders that were passed down from the chain of command.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about Khmer legacies, because what you've done, basically, is try to sort of make your experiences a model for what other people might try with their own families.
Yeah, what I really wanted to do was I wanted to channel all the interest and all the energy for making this film into a program that had that would have a lasting impact on Cambodian families. So I started this organization called Khmer Legacies, and the mission is to document the Cambodian genocide through personal videotape testimonies. So the idea is that the younger generation is interviewing their parents about their story of survival. Those interviews will be videotaped, and then those videotapes can be used as an educational tool to teach about genocide.
What have you seen so far? A lot that parallels your family's experience, or some things that are very different?
Yes, there is an awful lot that parallels my family's experience. Many, many marriages that were forced by the Khmer Rouge. Everyone my age was also born in the refugee camps. So it's almost like, you know, kind of a generation growing up through the same circumstances.
Has it been interesting to you to meet other people who are in your place?
It has been, and it's been very affirming and very rewarding to see that they love the film, that it resonates with their experience, that they find it to be useful as something that can open a new conversation with their parents. That's been really rewarding.
Do you think most Americans are adequately aware of what went on in Cambodia?
I don't think so, and I think most Americans aren't adequately aware of a lot of, you know, world events that are outside of our borders, and certainly historical events that, you know, did have a lot to do with America in the first place. And I think one of the messages of the film is that, you know, these catastrophes that happen in history, they continue to reverberate. You know, there are still echoes and the legacy of what happened continues for many generations.
Do you have children yourself?
I don't know.
Have you thought about if you had children, sort of how you begin this? Does it sort of start at birth and this is always part of the story that you tell them?
I think so, but I think you have to be careful about, you know, what exactly you tell children. Mm-hmm. You obviously don't want to traumatize them with your own experience. But for me, understanding my parents' story is one that made me feel closer and made the relationship deeper. My level of love and respect for my parents grew immensely through this process.
I want to talk for just a minute about a filmmaking choice that you made, because there is footage, there's, you know, videotape and film of what happened in Cambodia, but there are many sections of the film where instead you use a really interesting kind of animation. Can you talk about that decision?
Absolutely. The reason why I wanted to use animation in some of the sequences was because I knew that we didn't have any raw material to work with to tell these particular stories. For instance, there were no video of that story, no photos. I didn't want to use reenactments. Mm-hmm. And I was using archival footage for a different purpose, to set up the historical background. So I came up with this idea of animation. And the reason why I think it worked perfectly is because it captured kind of, you know, my childhood imaginations about what I thought the Khmer Rouge were. And it also played with this idea that the way you remember things is not necessarily how they happened.
Yeah, it is. It's this sort of dreamy effect that it's haunting and yet really oddly beautiful at the same time when you imagine the individuals that are surviving through all this.
Yeah, I'm very happy with how all of that turned out.
Were you scared to show the film to your family?
Of course I was. The very first time I showed it to them was on Christmas Day in 2006, so it was like we were coming full circle, and I can remember sitting in the back of the living room with my whole family and extended family there, and I was just shaking in my seat because I was so worried about what their reaction would be.
Do you think they sort of withheld? Did you see them sort of biting back tears and they didn't want to be very emotional about watching it?
Sure, a little bit, but they did cry. It was really very emotional. You know, it was also very funny for them because there were some very funny moments, and so they enjoyed laughing at themselves, but also, you know, they also cried a lot too.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about from the people you've heard of, what's been the most surprising response, or heard from rather?
I would have to say that the depth of the emotional resonance that the audience seems to have with this story, no matter what their background, what their family journey is of coming here to America, even all around the world, I mean, people really, really are touched and moved by this film, and also fall in love with my parents in a way that I never imagined when I was making it.
Yeah, it's easy to fall in love with your parents. They're delightful, and your whole family, it's a great story.
Thank you.
So Chita Pav is a filmmaker and CEO of the nonprofit group Khmer Legacies. You can find them online at khmerlegacies.org. The documentary New Year Baby debuts tonight at 10 on KERA Channel 13 television. So Chita, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Such a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.